Let's start with prayer. Heavenly Father, we bow down before you as recognizing that you are the creator of this universe. And not only have you created mankind, but you've created animals. And today we talk about the larger, some of the larger animals that you've created. Just the thought that you are far greater than any of these is a humbling thought. We ask your blessing on today, and we just pray that our thoughts would be glorifying to you, would be a blessing to you. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Rick, could you move a little bit?
Sure. How's that? I need all the help I can get. Is that okay? Good. Okay. The topic today is the one that's going to be let's put it this way. After today, you may not want to sit next to me in church. Darren here may not want to say that he acknowledges that he knows me, because, and Tom may not come to Growth Group, because what I'm going to say today may affect how you have been taught about dinosaurs in a way that you may think I'm kind of nuts. But remember that the point here of this class is not to think like I think, but it's just to begin to think. You own your own thoughts, and this is going to be food for thought. And in any of these classes, I don't expect any of you to wholeheartedly agree with what I'm doing until you check it out for yourself. So this is kind of like, maybe a good analogy goes like this. If we were to have a finance seminar and I were to, for several weeks, explain, and I don't know this stuff, but if I were to explain stocks and investing and stocks and like that, and how to invest your money, and then after a few meetings I'd come in and say, you know, last week I took $5,000 of your money and I put it here, there, and everywhere. Wouldn't you kind of like sit up in your seat and take a little bit more of a notice? Because now I have invested your personal whatever, okay? Dinosaurs are a personal part of everybody. When we grow up as kids and as adults, we're fascinated with dinosaurs. So when I deal with dinosaurs today, I'm dealing with something that is close to your brain. You may not think so now, but you will see as we do this that some of the stuff I'm going to talk about, you're going to say, well, I never learned that before, or that doesn't agree with what I think dinosaurs were like. And again, that's just because we are taught in school certain things that we may not agree today is the truth. So I just ask that you have an open mind, and Darren, I'll understand if you don't want to acknowledge that you know me after today. It's okay. Brainwasher's disease, you might recall what that is. You're taught one way of thinking and not a different way, and you can defend perhaps one way, if any way at all. Brainwasher disease starts early in life. Here are some examples. Everyone finds dinosaurs fascinating. They are the star attraction in the most common science book that are read by children, dinosaurs. It's even a cartoon. Is it Barney? Is that the dinosaur? Am I kind of dating myself here? I'm not even sure. Maybe he's extinct by now. I don't know. What children learn about dinosaurs can affect their faith. It really can. What they learn about dinosaurs can affect their faith. And that's the point that I want to make. I thought this was a great book. It's a pop-up book. It's really fun. It says on the first page, dinosaurs lived millions of years ago, long before there were any people on the earth. That's the first line. That one. Here's Peterson's first guide to dinosaurs. This is, you know, the Peterson guides of all different subjects. This is like for kids. No one has ever seen a living dinosaur. That's the very first line of that one. And then that I grew up with, some of you are as old as I am, and maybe you remember the Golden Book Encyclopedia, right? And here's what it says about dinosaurs. First line, no one has ever seen a dinosaur. The last dinosaurs disappeared about 60 million years ago, long before there were any people on the earth. Okay, and so, you know, kids are impressionable, very much so. I mean, adults are too, but after a while, adults kind of get numbed to certain things. And if you have a blank CD, right, or a floppy disk, you know, it can be programmed in a bunch of different ways. Once you get a bunch of stuff on there, it's tougher to reprogram things, right? That's kind of how I feel sometimes. Really tough to move things around. And of course, this verse in Proverbs comes to mind: train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he's old, he will not depart from it. You've all heard of that, right? I'm going to that for today's lesson. Train up a child in the opinion of others, and even when he's old, he will not depart from them. And I do think that that is true. You don't have to agree with me, but I really do think that there's a lot of truth in that. If a child is taught a certain way of thinking, they will defend it even when they are an adult. If they have nothing else to say, you know what, there are like two or three possibilities, here they are, and I've picked out one. That's kind of a mature way to think through things. Most people just believe something, and they, if they know how to defend it at all, that's the only thing that they will defend, and not give you the choices and say, this is why, this one out of the three, and why. Can brainwasher's disease be fatal? I think I told you earlier on it's not fatal. There is a solution or a cure for it. There is something, though, that can die. And although it's not the person, it's your faith. Faith in God can die if you have a better explanation for things than the Bible. Now, we all in this room, I think most of us would think the Bible is the better source of information, especially if you believe what we've been talking about this last few weeks. However, to someone that doesn't have that background, a logical thought process of saying, here's a fossil, it's so old, man, the earth must be old. You know, that kind of thing is a logical process that step by step is not so much what the Bible says. You know, a miracle occurred, God made things. I mean, a child may opt for the belief that is the easiest one to understand. Why would you believe in miracles when another explanation is easier to believe? It's just human nature to tend to believe the one that is the less complicated or the least out of the ordinary. Would you consider that miracles are out of the ordinary? Right? And so would you rather believe a miracle, or would you rather believe what your science teacher said in school? It's in the book, after all. It's on TV, and there's, you know, Barney and like that. And you're in the minority if you believe differently. And boy, it's just important for kids. Man, if you go to school and say God made the dinosaurs, I mean, if you're a little kid, maybe it's not a big deal, but as you get into the upper elementary grades, junior high, certainly in high school, man, you don't want to stand out. And even if you believe it, you're not going to usually, most kids are not going to stand up and make a big deal out of what they believe is true. So they tend to suppress what they're taught in church and what is taught in school. Can the statements made by the three children's books we just looked at, can they be falsified? Can you say what they said is that no one has ever seen a living dinosaur? Can you prove that that is wrong? Can you prove that that is right? Just think about those statements. Are they statements of fact? Just think about that. You can say anything you want in a book, I suppose, but can you falsify? See, if you can't falsify something, what's it always going to be? True. Right? If you can't prove that it's true, it could be false. But if you can't prove that it's false, bottom line, it's an opinion. Right? They cannot be falsified, so those statements are based on faith. Yeah. The only way to base it on the truth is to go back there, interview every person in the past, and say, have you seen a dinosaur? Right? When you think about the details of getting that I'm going to prove that no one's ever seen a living dinosaur, don't you have to have an interview with everybody? And they have to have a pretty good memory, right? You know, I think I saw one, or was I dreaming, or like that? Because there are a lot of unknowns, okay? These things that I've read are opinions. They are not supported by evidence, yet they're in books, and kids read them, and believe them. A lot of adults do, too. Okay, what do you see in these photographs? Through them slowly. When you look at this one, you think, boy, at least I thought so, you may not agree, it resembles a dinosaur, right? Now, whoever did this may have had a bad dream, and that's what they saw. Isn't that possible? We don't know what was in the mind of the person that did this. Here's some background on it. It's a pictograph. It's from the Grand Canyon. A man by the name of Doheny from Los Angeles, he sponsored an expedition in 1924. Why did he go back to the Grand Canyon? Because back in 1879, he was a young prospector, and he saw these pictographs, and he wanted to go back with some other people to photograph them. It's a red sandstone. It contains a trace of iron. That's why it's red. And this was written back in the 20s, so the language is interesting. But anyway, it's called desert varnish. It's a dark coating that forms on the rock, and if you peck it away, it exposes the lighter colored rock that has not been weathered yet. So it lasts an awfully long time. And it's not the only feature on this cliff in the Grand Canyon. There are other pictographs. There's even an elephant there without tusks to it, and a man next to it, and just all sorts of things. In fact, what I can do, I can pass around an Arizona magazine, Arizona Highways magazine, 1951. Good year. I was born in that year. Pass this around. You're welcome to have a closer look at the wall on which that one is located. There you go. The size of this is about a foot high. It's 11 inches high and like that, and so about 4 inches wide as far as the body goes. So, is it a dinosaur? I really don't know. It kind of looks like a dinosaur. It's in North America, and it was obviously made by someone that had some intelligence, probably a human, and probably not some bird or something that was pecking away at the cliff. At least I haven't met a bird quite that ingenious. Although I have a hummingbird that's nesting in the same nest, second year in a row, in my patio. The books say they don't do that, so, you know, you never know. You never know. And so there's some other symbols there, too. And I've got the website there. And the printed materials that I hope to have for you next week, if not next week, the week after, I promise to get them to you. They'll be all together in a binder, and they'll have the web page there that you can read all of about this. How about this one? What does that remind you of? Oh, see? You knew about dinosaurs. See, I told you. They're close. You remember this name, Stegosaurus, right? And you probably aren't old enough to have been there when this was around, but... I wasn't. How about that one? Dinosaur's okay. It's a D word. How about that one? All right, dinosaur, huh? How about this one? This looks like maybe a flying dinosaur. Huh? How about that one? Don't these kind of look like dinosaurs? Something's going on here that's not right here. They look like dinosaurs, huh? From? Oh, here's another one. Allosaurus, perhaps? Right. Okay. These are six. I just took six off the website. It's an archaeological site that was discovered in 1944 by a German man. He was a hardware merchant in Mexico. He discovered them by accident, as the story goes. They're about 500 BC to 500 AD. Over 20,000 of these have been found. They're clay and stone. None of them were duplicates of one another. So they were not mass-produced by whoever made them. They range in size from a few inches long to statues that are set 3 feet high, 4 to 5 feet long. 20,000 of them, and most of them are animals. And the majority of those that are animals are dinosaurs like those. The dinosaur varieties that are identified by the shape, of course, they can't talk to you and they don't come with tags, but by looking at the shape, you can see that there's about 20 different dinosaur shapes and types that have been identified. There's even a museum down there that has all for people to see. How about this one? See anything here that might look dinosaurish? You can see to the lower left here. This is a burial stone from Peru. In the lower left part of this, you'll see a large animal with kind of the spines on its back there. The Diplodocus, the very large, the equivalent of a brontosaurus, you know, that was later corrected to be an apatosaurus. Up until recently, we thought that the back was smooth, but then there was some skin that was discovered a few years ago, and so the skin actually shows these little serrated edges. Here's another one from Peru. What does that remind you of? Triceratops. You guys are good. Triceratops. Yeah, good. Okay, now, I did not see the people make these things. So they could not be genuine, made by people in the way past. They could have been made last year, right, by somebody. See, I don't have personal knowledge of these things. But they're interesting, huh? The last two are ceremonial burial stones from Peru and probably at least several hundred years old. Now, it's possible that people could make these things to make money, right, to try and fool science. There have been several hoaxes over the years where people have done that. But because I don't know personally if they're really as old as people say they are, you know, there's always some uncertainty to all of this. But I thought they were interesting to point out to you. There's a study, and this is an actual science, a bona fide science. It's called paleocryptozoology. It's a new area of study. What it does is it compares paleontology, which is the study of fossils, with archaeological artifacts and ancient records. In other words, like tapestry, pictographs, petroglyphs, like that. And then written records emphasizing common morphological features. Okay, to make a long story short, if a fossil was kind of distinctive in its anatomy, then maybe the descriptions of animals in the past that show that describe that very same anatomy would be evidence that maybe they existed with people. Describe these things. Here's a great, great article. It's on the internet. It's about a flying reptile. Here's a fossil of one of these things from a really good website. It's a Berkeley website. If you want to know about dinosaurs and you want to see great pictures, it's a super, super website. Fossil of one of these things. This fossil has a distinct morphological feature, is the tail. Notice the tail kind of goes out there. It's about the thickness of your little finger, and it flares out there at the end. It has wings to it, and you might notice that right at the bend of the wing, there are some claws, three claws. You might think that that's kind of dinosaurish-like, and well, there are three living birds that have those claws right there at the wing. Now, this is supposed to be a reptile. I'm just saying that there are three birds. The ostrich, the turaco, and the hudson are living examples of them that have the claws and like that. So they're not unusual. They're not only in the fossil record. They're in some living things, too. Anyway, the tail vein, and also this has a distinctive skull. So what this guy did was he looked through the records and looking at visual things like petroglyphs and like that to see if there were any of these things that had those two features because they're distinctive. Fossil. So he looked, and this is an interesting study because it has the potential of totally revising our understanding of the geologic column. In other words, if we can show that these things lived at the same time as humans, not hundreds of millions of years ago, the geologic column that we talked about last week, you know, the Earth history and everything like that, shrinks considerably, if not altogether shrinks, to be consistent with the Bible, that a flood of 1 year's duration, roughly, put down most of the rocks. So this guy's a creationist, and he's very much into this. So far, he's found about 24 species of extinct animals, all thought to be extinct for millions of years. But he says, but almost certainly, accurately observed, notice the wording here, by man in the recent past. Therefore, the entire idea of geological succession of many of the layers of strata at different ages, based on index fossils, you know, matching them by the fossils we talked about last week, may soon be untenable. In other words, if you can show that the dinosaurs and like that lived with man, then to say that they lived hundreds of years ago is like, how could that be? Unless humans were back then. That's another possibility, right? Okay, here's what he says in his article. Most written records of flying reptiles in the Middle East are rather generic. They're kind of like general. They all sound similar. They contain little distinguishing detail. However, this man by the name of Alpin, a European scientist who wrote a natural history of Egypt in the years 1581 to 1584, he's provided a more detailed account of these flying reptiles. By the way, this article that I took this from is only about the pterosaur, the flying reptile that he is investigating. He's going to have one on T-Rex coming out shortly and some others that he's working on slowly. And they're all going to be on the internet, which is really neat. You'll be able to get it, you know, quickly. And because otherwise, what they do is they give these papers at the international conference on conferences on creation that are like every 4 years. You have to wait for 4 years to see it or get one of the creation journals. And if you don't want to subscribe to them, they're tough to get. They're not in the newsstands and like that. Anyway, there is nothing for sure about the basilic. Basilic is the general term for these flying reptiles. This is a quote from back in the 1500s. But we have heard talk, nevertheless, that there is a small serpent as long as a palm branch and thick like a small finger. It has a small piece of skin like a crest on its head. That matches with the fossil, right? In the middle of the back, two scales provided placed on one on each side and the other, which serve as wings in order to advance quickly. Continuing with that quote, large numbers of people have said that these serpents live in large quantities close to certain lakes in which the Nile has its source. People don't travel close to those lakes because of the well-known danger that these serpents represent. That is, what is said by the Egyptians who travel in Ethiopia and in Nubia. So they've got a reputation that's not good. It's not like come here kind of a thing, like the cat that just adopted my other cats yesterday. This description agrees with the fossils in that there's a crest on the head that you just read about. The thickness of the tail is about right. The size of this type of pterosaur dinosaurs about right. Here are some sketches back at about the 1500s of these things. Today we look at these and we think somebody must have had too much to drink, or you know, something encouraged their imagination. But you know, if we didn't know that there are bugs that light up at night, if we didn't know there are these snake-looking things in the water that can shock a man, if we didn't know there's a bug that can produce a liquid that's about the temperature of boiling water and aim that at whatever's bothering the bug, if we didn't know these things were really alive and we could study them, we may also think, you know, no one would think that that kind of animal would exist if someone were to tell you without actually having a living example. Okay? So I just want to remind you that when you look at this, the first thing that comes to mind, because we've been all brainwashed, is to think, right, that can't be real. Somebody made that up. Here's another person writing in the year 1650. He was described here as an outstanding scholar. He's competent in several languages. And he gives the most outstanding study of biblical animals ever penned. So he did research into this. He, after arguing that the flying serpents in Isaiah were still alive, we'll talk more about them in a moment, he relates several accounts. Let's just kind of see what he said. This is him talking now, 16-something. If on your travels you encounter the serpent with wings who circles and hurls himself at you, the flying snake, hide yourself, because of its reputation. Lie down when the snake appears, guard yourself in alarm, for that snake's manner is to go away calm, considering it a victory. In other words, cry uncle in a quiet way and maybe take off. And that's kind of, that is also one of the strategies of the grizzly bear you might have heard about. It's like, you know, don't put up a big deal and maybe they'll go away. They'll think you're dead perhaps. And continuing with his quote, there are winged and flying serpents that can be found who are venomous, who snort and are savage, and kill with pain worse than fire. Try to remember that one to come to this. Yeah, especially if you see one, keep that in mind. Okay, now here's a biblical connection to all of this. To indicate a winged reptile, in Latin, the writers used the term basilic, B-A-S-I-L-I-C. Now, in one version of the Greek edition of the Old Testament, the Isaiah 30, 6, chapter 30, verse 6 passage, this word is used. It's a similar word in the Greek. It's B-A-S-I-L-S-K, and it's used for the flying serpent that's mentioned there in Isaiah 30, verse 6. Now, this translation is done in a whole bunch of different Bibles, except for the NIV. The NIV does not translate this animal as a flying serpent, but all the other, like the NAS does, the New American, the King James does, and like that. So if you have an NAS or King James, you'll see that in Isaiah 30, it's translated as a serpent. The Hebrew word for this same creature is, of course, not the same as the Greek word. That was a Greek translation of the Hebrew. The Hebrew word is seraph. I think that's how it's pronounced. Strong's 83:14. It occurs seven times in the Old Testament verses. One of them was the one in Isaiah that you just looked at, 30 verse 6. And five of the seven where it occurs in the Old Testament describes them as flying. So they're serpents that fly, five out of the seven. Okay? Now, when you look at the Strong's definition of this word, it means burning, figuratively, poisonous, a serpent, specifically a seraph or symbolical creature. From their copper color, fiery serpent, like that. So that's the word that it comes from the Hebrew. Okay, here's some interesting similarities. The context of Isaiah 30, verse 6 is Egypt. When you read that section, that chapter, it's talking about when the Assyrians came to attack Israel. Who did Israel go to? Egypt instead. Good, Gordon, I'm glad you... My memory is... you're verifying my memory, that's good. They went to Egypt instead of God, and so the whole area there is dealing with Egypt. That's the context area. The same Hebrew word is used for the serpents in the wilderness. In Deuteronomy 8:15, there's a description there of the wandering of Israel, and when they went through the wilderness, you'll see here. I'll show you the verse. The serpents are described as part of the experience there, wandering in the wilderness. And it's the same Hebrew word used for the serpents that the Lord sent to bite the people You might recall that one. You know, they got rid of the whole thing by putting a serpent on the pole. Remember that whole? That whole, you remember that, right? That's in Numbers 21:6. So it's the same Hebrew word. Okay? Same Hebrew word. So here's that verse in Isaiah. This is the one that's mentioned in the article, Isaiah 36. The oracle concerning the beasts of the Negev, through a land of distress and anguish, from where come lioness and lion, viper and flying serpent, there's that word, seraph, they carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys and their treasures on camels' humps to a people who cannot profit them. Again, I think referring to Egypt, God is saying, they're not going to be profited by going to Egypt. I'm the Lord, I can help you, but not the ones. Okay, and here's the other one in Deuteronomy, the other place where this is, one of the places. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents, again same Hebrew word, and scorpions, and the thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. You might recall, right, where Moses got the water out of the. And here's in Numbers. The Lord sent fiery serpents, again the same word, among the people, and they bit the people. So that many people of Israel died. Okay, so that might be a memorable passage for you. I told you you're going to think I'm nuts, but just think about this here. Were the fiery serpents sent by the Lord pterosaurs? Were they what is supposedly only in the fossil record? Were they pterosaurs? Okay, let's take a look at some things. Interesting things that there might be. They were seen in Egypt at least as late as the 1600s. If you go back to the descriptions that we just looked at, and if they were there in the 1600s, perhaps they were there earlier than that. Right? They were avoided by travelers because they would be attacked. Right? I mean, that's consistent with these things coming and doing what to the people of Israel? Right? Not squawking at them and bothering them, but killing them. Right? They lived together in great numbers. I would suppose that if you had lots of people and they were dying, you probably would need a bunch of birds to do it. Not just one or two or three, but a bunch. And their venom would kill with pain, worse than fire. That was part of the description that we just read. Could the fire that the Bible describes, fiery serpents, could the fire refer to the pain of the bite instead of a flame? Isn't it interesting when we read words, we tend to have a mental picture of what we're reading. And of course, a flame implies to me, maybe to you, a yellow or a blue flame, right? With smoke perhaps, something like that. Maybe the fiery here refers to what they do in the killing of people and what they experience, and not necessarily that they were fire-breathing serpents. Okay, it's just an idea that would be some food for thought. Remember in here, if you're thinking, that's good. That's the whole goal here. You don't have to think like me. I'm just giving you some information to think about. That's speaking of thinking, what are you inclined to believe? Did humans and dinosaurs live at the same time, only hundreds or thousands of years ago, or are they separated by millions of years? Could humans have acquired the knowledge of dinosaurs, like you saw there in the little clay small dinosaurs and like that, and the descriptions that you've read? Could humans have acquired the knowledge of dinosaurs by observing them firsthand? Okay, now that's. Right, if I went to UCLA, the geology department said that, right, they would tell me that I never graduated from UCLA. I think I would probably be disowned, or I would be sent over to the mythology department or something. Perhaps God made them both on day 6 of the creation week. It's a very old thought, but according to God, a wise one, because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and if we believe that he created things, I think that's a good first step, that he is the one responsible for someone or something else. Let's shift our attention now to dragons. The last article we looked at was a specific article about that cryptozoology, right? Let's just take a look in general at the dragons. If one cares to look for them, there are thousands of instances where land dragons and water monsters and flying serpents have made an impression on mankind. Some of them in less than a century ago. You know, when you think about stories of dragons, a thing that comes to my mind is, yeah, there's one or two stories, right? There are thousands of them. And what you need to do is just get a reference that really goes through them, and you'll have more than one, I mean, guaranteed. And this is the best reference. This book is so good. If it wasn't on the internet, I'd buy it. I'm a cheap person. I But it's all on the internet, and it's called After the Flood. And this guy goes through and goes through the descendants from Noah to, I think he stops in the, what, the 1700s, like that, tracing the genealogies. He has chapters on dragons, chapters on Ice Age, all sorts of neat things. I mean, and there's the website. It's revelationwebsite.co.uk. You can just search in, if you want to just search for After the Flood, and the whole thing is there on the internet. Reading. This guy is 25 years it took him to get to compile the information for this book. He records the pterosaurs in the British Isles as late as the early 1900s. Now, this guy lives in the UK, so he's really into what's there. He even has access to the Queen's personal library and took some stuff out of there, you know, one-of-a-kind books and like that to look at. So here's what he says here. The woods around a certain castle there has a reputation of being frequented by winged serpents. These were the terror of the old and young alike. An aged inhabitant of this place, he died a few years ago, said that in his boyhood, the winged serpents were described as very beautiful. They were coiled when in repose and looked as if they were covered with jewels of all sorts. Some of them had crests sparkling with all the colors of the rainbow. When disturbed, they glided swiftly, sparkling all over, to their hiding places. When angry, they flew over people's heads with outspread wings, bright, and sometimes with eyes too, like the feathers in a peacock's tail. Isn't it interesting that the part of the definition for Strong's there was a copper color? And copper, you know, it's not the same as this, but it maybe kind of is an interesting similarity there, that copper and like that. In fact, the principal ore of copper is chalcopyrite, and there's also one called bornite, and both of them have this kind of peacock coloration to them. So there's a connection that way with copper. He said it was no old story invented to frighten children, but a real fact. His father and uncle had killed some of them, for they were as bad as foxes for poultry. The old man attributed the extinction of the winged serpents to the fact that they were terrors in the farmyards and the coverts. And I think if something's going to bother your animals, I mean, that's the number one no-no to a person that raises animals, right? As late as August 1614, the following sober account was given of a strange reptile that was encountered in Sussex. The sighting was near a village that was known as Dragon's Green long before the report was published. And again, this is Mr. Cooper speaking in this. And then here is the quote he is from this old article. This serpent, or dragon as some call it, is reputed to be 9 feet, notice the spelling here, 9 feet or rather more in length, and shaped almost in the form of an axle tree of a cart. And I have never had a cart, so I really can't say that I've ever seen an axle tree. A quantity of thickness in the middest and somewhat smaller at both ends. I suppose we're talking like me, I suppose. A bit bigger in the middle and thinner at each end. Might be. Oh! Well, that makes good sense. The differential of the rear axle, bigger in the middle, and thank you. That's good. The former part, which he shoots forth as a neck, is supposed to be about 3.5 feet long, with a white ring, as it were, of scales about it. And we're talking about some detailed, some interesting details. The scales along its back seem to be blackish, and so much as is discovered under its belly appear to be red. It is likewise discovered to have large feet, but the eye may be deceived, for some suppose that serpents have no feet. The dragon rids away, as we call it, as fast as a man can run. Now, that's kind of discouraging when you consider if they're running after you. Yeah. Lava can go about as, typically basaltic lava, about as fast as you can run. So if you're ever like in Hawaii and things open up, it's a good idea to get a head start on this, one. His food, rabbits, is thought to be, for the most part, in a Connie Warren. It must be maybe a wooded area, perhaps, that he much some place, I suppose, that he frequents. So continuing with this, there are likewise upon either side of him discovered two great bunches, so big as a large football. I guess that's why he's big in the middle here, as some think, will in time grow into wings. But God, I hope, will defend the poor people in this neighborhood, that he shall be destroyed before he grows to a more of an adulthood. You got that? There's only one book with that one in. One of the locals, this is another instance told by Cooper, one of the locals set his two mastiffs onto the monster, and apart from losing his dogs, he was fortunate to escape alive from the encounter, for the dragon was already credited with the deaths of a man and woman at whom it had spat, and who consequently had been killed by its venom. That could be a pretty effective way of killing someone, right? I mean, if you don't have to get to touch them, all you have to do is be a good spitter, huh? When approached unwittingly, our pamphleteer, I think that's the person telling him things, tells us that was, continuing here, of countenance very proud, and at the sight of hearing of men or cattle will raise his neck upright and seem to listen and look about with great arrogancy. And then Cooper says, an eyewitness account of typically reptilian behavior. I used to catch lizards. I used to do it for the Park Service when I worked there. And it's interesting when you look at the lizard before you catch it to look at it, and, you know, look at it up close. It would look at you, and maybe you've seen this, it has an arrogant look to it. I mean, I've never seen a lizard that had a, you know, smiled at me like cats and like that. They have an arrogant look to them. I think it's kind of a typical view that they have. Scotland's famous Loch Ness, you knew it was coming, right? Yeah? Right? Is only one of many aquatic monsters that have been observed. A loch is a bay, a lake or a bay, of the sea, usually narrow and nearly confined or surrounded by land. So if you have a sea level rising in an area where there was a river that cut or a glacier that cut a canyon or valley, as sea level rises, what would happen to that canyon? It would be flooded, right? So we're looking at flooded canyons like that. Okay, California's got a bunch, but we don't call them lochs. Here's a bunch of other lochs there that are in that part of the world. One of them there is 1,000 feet deep. Plenty of room for something to hide. They also have records of monster activity. Loch Ness is probably, though, the most famous of these. Indeed, there have been over 40 sightings at Loch Morar, I think that's how it's pronounced, alone since the end of the last war, and over 1,000 from Loch Ness in the same period. Now, you could easily argue, if something goes on that attracts people, that's called money, and you would continue doing that because money keeps flowing in. There's lots of reasons why someone might publicize something unusual, or even make dinosaur footprints and then make human footprints, and you don't make these things. So I'm not saying that all of these reports are true. I can't say that because I don't have all, but it's to consider. Just consider it. You don't have to believe it. I don't doubt it. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Water monster reports are not limited to the British Isles. Here's an account that occurred in Italy in the year 1484. There was found within a great river, the Po in Italy, a monster, marine or of the sea, of the likeness that they're going to describe here. He had the form or the making of a fish, that which part was in two halves, that which is to wit double. You're going to have to try to interpret some of this here. He had a great beard, and he had, now what they meant by beard, again, I really don't know. But anyway, he had two wonderfully great horns above his ears. Also, he had great paps. I did look that one up. A pap would be a nipple, like two nipples, and a wonderfully great and horrible mouth. I'm not use those words today, but they did. And at both of his elbows he had wings, right broad and great of fish's armor, wherein he swimmed, but the head out of the water. His head was out of the water only, right? It happened then that many women laundered and washed at the port or haven of this river, where this terrible and fearful beast was, who for lack of default of meat came swimming toward the said woman. In other words, it was in trouble. I think I'm paraphrasing here. The lady was in trouble, and the woman came to her rescue here. of which he took one by the hand and supposed to have drawn her into the water, but she was strong and well advised and resisted against the said monster, and as she defended herself she began to cry out with a high voice, "Help, help," and to which came running five women, which by hurling and drawing of stones killed and slew the said monster, for he was come too far within the sound, wherefore he might not return to deep water. I suppose he was shallow and might swim away too easily. And after, when he rendered his spirit, I suppose that's when he's dead, right? He made a right little cry, whatever that means. He was of great corpulence. I looked up that word too, and that means fat, right? He's, yeah, more than any man's body. And yet, this person here said in this manner that he being at, let's see, he saw the said monster. This person saw the said monster and said that, saith yet that the young children were accustomed for to go bathing and to wash them within the river, but they came not all again. I suppose I wouldn't if that was known to be a place where there was a monster. Wherefore the women neither washed nor laundered their clothes at the port. I think that would also be reasonable, for the folk presumed and supposed that the monster had killed the young children which were drowned. So, I mean, it's a pretty sketchy description there, but the reason why I included that is that it's not a typical one like in the British Isles like that. It's down a bit in Italy. Mr. Cooper also discusses instances when flying dragons describe very much like pterodactyls. Now, a pterodactyl and pterosaur are usually used interchangeably. One is the one is an order term and the other is a family term. So both refer to the flying reptile beings, animals. They were observed in large numbers before bad weather. Now just think about it. In the Antelope Valley here, when do you see seagulls in the Antelope Valley? When it's stormy, yeah. When there's a storm, they come here, right? They would not come here. Most people would not come here unless they had a good reason to come here, like work or like that, or a seagull who may be coming inland because of a storm. And so the behavior of animals, you know, I mean, it's not that far-fetched. When my dogs are hungry, they act like it, right? Strange animal behavior before earthquakes is very well known. Going back to the time of the Greeks, in fact, there are earthquakes. There was one predicted in Haicheng in China 2 months before it occurred. In fact, they were so sure the earthquake was going to occur, the Chinese government showed movies outside of buildings to get people out of the buildings. And sure enough, it happened about when they said it was going to. And that was 2 months before snakes came out of the ground, froze to death on the surface, died for some good reason. I suppose you don't die unless you have a good reason, unless you're a lemming, I guess. But strange animal behavior before earthquakes, animals moving with response to an incoming storm. What they saw here were these pterodactyls in groups were flying to the east, and storms in Europe, like so we have storms, they come from west and move to the east. So people saw that. Now let's direct our attention now to the Bible. The Bible in the book of Job describes something called behemoth. It just means large animal. It's not specific to a particular animal, but it means large animal. Now, this is a part of God's science exam that God's giving Job. Remember the questions we talked about? Halfway through, Job says, "Woe is me." At the end, he says, "Surely I speak of things that I really had no clue about," basically. God has the answers, and Job does not. God starts his description with a behemoth in chapter 40, about halfway through, with a really interesting verse. "Behold now, behemoth, which I made as well as you." Interesting way to put it, huh? Behold now, behemoth. Now, when he's speaking to Job, and the whole exam is speaking to Job, isn't that kind of like me saying, "Behold the flags outside in the parking lot that someone tied on things"? Right? It's like I'm explaining things to you that you know about. You think maybe God would say, "Behold the fossil you've never seen in the rocks of something I made a long time ago." Right? When you read this section, it is very easy to imagine that God is speaking to Job about something that Job knows about. And it's a good thing to read and just kind of see if that is the impression you get if you read chapter 40 of Job. God speaks as though Job knows Behemoth. You know, that's something you just need to see for yourself by reading that, see if you agree with me. Here are the characteristics of Behemoth. He eats grass like an ox in verse 15. This is all chapter 40. His strength is in his loins. I suppose that means he has muscular legs, right? His power is in the muscles of his belly. Verse 16. He bends his tail like a cedar in verse 17. More on Behemoth. His bones are like tubes of bronze in verse 18. His limbs are like bars of iron, also in verse 18. He is first in the ways of God. Now, when you think about the ways of God, it's not like a budget car, right? The ways of a budget car may not have a radio and may be kind of like my Hyundai, and which can barely get out of its way because it's really old and needs a lot of work. I think the ways of God are like the upper end, right? We're talking super stereos. We're talking big engines. We're talking God is like, right? In the ways of God, first in the ways of God. So that's a pretty impressive statement, right? I think that's kind of describing an unusual animal to be first in the ways of God. He is not alarmed when a river rages. So when the river is flooding, it's like no big deal, right? Probably because he's large, perhaps, maybe. He cannot be captured when he is on watch. So what is Behemoth, or what was Behemoth, depending upon your perspective? Okay. Interesting thing we can look at. If we limit our possibilities to current living animals, current living ones, only the ones that are alive now, what could it be? We have some possibilities, and these are commonly described in the footnotes in Bibles and like that, commentaries. It could be hippopotamus, right? Because they are in the water and they eat vegetation and like that. So they live in the environment. So does a rhinoceros, and so does an elephant. Okay. So, and I'm sure you've heard the problems with those, and but they're probably the biggest, the most commonly known problem with those first three is that their tails don't bend like a cedar. I mean, the description of a tail, look at the tail, it's kind of like wimpy and like that. So describing the tail of a hippopotamus or a rhinoceros and elephant as moving like a cedar, I don't think would be the first on the mind of whoever might be describing the animal. Okay? But if we include all animals, living or dead, include them all, as including in the fossil record, then the best choice is a sauropod dinosaur. Sir, if you think back to Jurassic Park, the one that sneezed on him in the tree. Remember that part of the movie? Yeah. How could the head be so high they were in the tree? Because it was such a great big animal. We're talking over 100 feet long like that. Very high. Okay, how about Leviathan? Leviathan is another interesting animal that is described in Job. In chapter 41 of Job, a bit different than Behemoth. Leviathan does some really interesting things. He sneezes flashes of light in verse 18 of chapter 41. He issues smoke from his nostrils. That's verse 20 of chapter 41. In verse 21 of chapter 41, he issues flames from his mouth. He has underparts like sharp pot shards. Okay, that's verse 30. Okay, so what is Leviathan? If we limit our possibilities to current living animals, then it could be a crocodile. I mean, that's what's very commonly in the footnotes of Bibles and commentaries. But what is the belly of a crocodile like? I don't have one, but it's really, really smooth. You know, one of the most terrifying times in my life, in West Los Angeles, I used to go from backyard to backyard to backyard, crawling over fences, walking on garage tops and like that. It's just something kids do. And kids in the country have country to play in. I was in West Los Angeles, so I went from backyard to backyard. I jumped into one backyard right next to a caiman, like 4 feet long. It looked to me like it was 20 feet long. It hissed at me, and I was scared out of my mind because I jumped off the wall, and I didn't see it when I jumped, off the wall onto the grass, and this thing was a pet in the person's backyard. It stopped me from doing this. It scared me so much. In fact, I even ran home. I was like 7, 8 years old. I ran home and told my parents I was so terrified. And I went back with my parents, and in fact, the person let me, I explained what happened, you know, I was doing this, and they let me go out and actually petted it. It was not as bad as that. But you know, when a kid jumps in the backyard and you see one of these things, it's kind of... Anyway, maybe you've seen the belly of these things. They are not sharp like pot shards. Okay? It's not. Does a crocodile breathe fire? I've never met one. I don't know if you have. But if we include all sea life in the present and the past, could it be a sea monster? There are some descriptions of sea monsters where they are described as having fire or smoke coming out of them. And I could not find an example of one that said that, but it's just referred to in several references that I looked at. So I can't give you a, here's what somebody said in the year, whatever. But I'll keep looking and see if I can find one. And this is what I wonder. I wonder if God smiled when he made Leviathan and thought something like, here's one that'll impress him. It's got some pretty impressive qualities. I think you might agree. Kind of like the bombardier beetle of the bug world. It's like if a bug saw the bombardier beetle do its thing and could talk to other bugs intelligently, it's like, man, do I have something to show you? This bug is something else. Mixing two chemicals that get really hot and then... it's able to steer it and then shoot it at whatever it might be in its way or bothering him. In the book of Nehemiah, we read, "You alone are the Lord. You have made the heavens of heavens with all their host, the earth and all that is on it." That would include animals, wouldn't it? "The seas and all that is in them." That would include the living things in the sea. "You give life to all of them, and the heavenly host bows down before you." Now, if you think all means all, that's God did it all. Right? You may not believe that all means all. Of course, that's your prerogative to believe that. And here's what God says about Leviathan to Job. "Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me?" Boy, is that a great verse. It's like saying, here's the most terrifying animal, or at least one of the most terrifying, and you can't deal with him. How about the maker of this animal? Deal with that one. That's God putting himself in the place that he deserves. Would you might agree with this? So, you know, when you talk about the fear of the Lord, man, if you're not afraid of this animal, all you have to do, if you were to meet one, is to test to see if you really deserve the not being afraid concept. Because, boy, if I met one of these things, I'll guarantee I would definitely be on the afraid side, like I was when I jumped into that yard, like that. Do you believe that behemoth and leviathan refer to real creatures? Interesting thought, huh? You may have read the Bible and thought in the past maybe those were stories that were not true. Maybe they weren't real. Or maybe when you've read Isaiah and Numbers and Deuteronomy, maybe you thought that word serpent was really not referring to a real animal of some kind. You probably never thought of pterosaur. I didn't either until I did some reading about this, right? Now, you normally don't think about pterosaurs when you read Isaiah. I mean, those are two topics that, you know, one's like science and the other's the Bible. If so, when do you think that they lived? Okay, so it's kind of interesting that if they were real, when did they live? And if they lived with humans, it's an interesting conclusion we can make. Here's my point of all of this for the last hour or so. If dinosaurs lived at the same time as man, if they did, which is consistent with a literal interpretation of Scripture, right? Then the age of the dinosaurs, being hundreds of millions of years ago, is an illusion. In other words, not real. Okay? That's heresy in the geology world, right? And that's why I say you may not want to sit next to me in church anymore, because it is so ingrained in people's minds that the dinosaurs lived in their age and not with humans, that concept should, at the very least, not come from anybody that's had an education in geology. It's kind of like not a few people think I'm nuts. But I suppose if you believe the Bible literally, as I do, there'd be a lot of reason to think I'm nuts, because a lot of stuff in the Bible is like miracles, right, that you just can't prove in a scientific way are true.